your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstand Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning, family and friends. Happy Easter Sunday. In case you hadn't noticed, that froze in my throat. But other important things, life is changing in manners that either make me mad or just gross me out. First, let me say that in our society, continuing to speak on your cell phone while attempting to interact face-to-face with another person is still rude. How much of an ass are you if you can't even say, "Excuse me a sec," to the phone caller so that you can complete whatever you need to do with the person you are in front of? Thanks to several products, the next generation, and possibly the current, will never understand this faux pas. And will have no face-to-face social skills. I drive by groups of kids waiting for the morning school bus, and each one of them is listening to their iPod, withdrawn into their own musical world, secluding themselves from the others, standing a few feet from them, or sitting next to them on the bus. Text messages, email, and IMs are the standard method of communicating for the younger crowd today. Cell phones are glued to the ear, thumbs are becoming ambidextrous, and oddly large, thanks to video games and text messaging. Our villages have stopped raising the children and left the machines to do it. But it's not just the younger crowd with these traits. Certainly you've noticed all the folks talking to themselves these days. Possibly you are one of them. Actually, they're not talking to themselves, just the people we can't see. Look at the ever-growing population of folks wearing one of those Bluetooth mobile phone accessories. That's the mechanical device attached to the ear so that you can talk on your phone while freely moving and using your hands. And again, I find it somewhat impolite to knowingly choose to converse with someone not even in the room when you are standing in front of another from which you want something. But were any of you also aware that you are taking the risk of becoming cyborgs? You know, those sci-fi beings that are half-human and half-machine. As someone who has read a lot of Stephen King and Isaac Asimov, I await the time when the earpiece actively wires itself to the brain and then begins to take over the body. Let's face it, we've already let them take over so many other things in our lives. In the beginning, I just used to mock these folks wearing the mobile headphones. These people walked around stores carrying on one-sided conversations while appearing as though they were on break from their McDonald's drive-thru job. I called them fast food escapees. Then there were the guys, always guys, using the walkie-talkie cell phone as if I wanted to hear the screech of their phone and listen to them yelling back into it. But I've moved beyond making fun to being worried. The pace of inventions has brought us to a place where we choose to be selfish and impolite because being so socially secluded doesn't allow us to think of others. True, having these mobile devices does allow us to communicate with nearly anyone we choose when we choose, but that doesn't make us more socially competent. Like the iPod, these phones block out the rest of the world and the people in it. Text messaging and instant messages do not allow for vocal inflection, despite the addition of emoticons. Cell phones fail to convey body language. I understand that to many, maximizing your time is important, but why are you doing this if the only skills you'll ever have for the extra time you generate are walking and talking alone? All right, so somebody with their little Bluetooth thing really pissed me off this week, but nonetheless. God, is it just me or is it hot in here? Maybe it's because Barbara Norton's in the room. Hey, Barbara, how are you?
I'm really good, and I love coming on this show, Rick.
Well, thank you so much for being here again. I always like to make sure that people donating time on their Sunday mornings get the appropriate thanks. We're here today to talk about, I guess it's 20 years ago in March, correct?
20 years ago.
A 20-year-old, does that qualify as a cold case if it's 20 years?
Well, not according to the UVA Police Department when anyone tries to see the case file.
All right, so we are talking about Patrick Collins, disappearance of Patrick Collins 20 years ago in March with Barbara Norton, a local journalist and investigative reporter. I like that phrase.
I love it.
Let's talk about Patrick Collins in a brief manner. Who is he? Why was he in town? That sort of thing.
In terms of who he is, I think he's some remains buried somewhere out in the country now. I think he has been for about 20 years and a few weeks. Pat was a graduate student who had just moved to Charlottesville. He came here right before Christmas, 1985. Mid-January, he enrolled as a PhD student in physiology in Jordan Hall at UVA. He had a desk in room 486, which is a key thing. We'll come right back to that. He rented a basement apartment on Montrose Avenue in Belmont. His family was back in California. His one half-sister was in Florida. So that gives you the basic setup. He had wanted very much to come to UVA, which is also important because UVA, once he disappeared, started insisting he must have run away from his life. But there was no sign of that. So he didn't get to know very many people well in that short time. He had one weekend trip over February of Valentine's Day, 1986. He went with three other guys from the department to Poconos cabin that was owned by one guy's parents. But otherwise, he pretty well kept himself. He was pretty stressed out by being a graduate student. He was probably overstressed. He was very compulsive about studying all the time. He had a very well-known lockstep routine. He would drive his car, ride his bike up to grounds during the day, go back for dinner at his apartment, and then take off in his car and study throughout the evening at the medical center. The last he was ever seen by people who later tried to reconstruct his movements, he was in a class on Friday, March 21st. We know that he was still alive on March 22nd because he withdrew $40 from an ATM at the Commonwealth Center, which is now a credit union branch at the corner of McIntyre and Preston.
That's the one by the Omni, right?
Yeah, that's the one right down from the Omni. And then he disappeared into thin air. That was 2:27 on the afternoon of Saturday, March 22nd, 1986. He was never seen again. It took 2 weeks before a fellow graduate student started asking around, has anybody seen Pat? And when they did some research, they went to room 486 in Jordan Hall and found that his backpack was there on his desk with all the IDs and his keys, and I think his glasses were there. There was an overhead compartment, a locked compartment that was open with his textbooks. And for those 2 weeks, anyone walking in and out would have looked at that and said, well, I guess Pat's around here somewhere. So his parents were traveling in Korea and Hawaii, taking a trip. His landlady had gotten quite ill and been taken to UVA Hospital the morning after he disappeared. And as was her practice, she, you know, first tried to, you know, get hold of him. She was sort of a mother hen. So she, first when she realized she was really ill, called downstairs and was surprised when there was no answer, but went ahead and called an ambulance, and ambulance came, and as she was being carried out, she thought, well, now that's odd, because Pat's car is here. I wonder why he didn't answer when I called, but she didn't think about it and didn't find out. In fact, her family kept it from her because they were afraid it would make her worse. She didn't find out for some time later that, in fact, he had disappeared. So he was just gone, and when they went, the the fellow graduate student looking for him, and one of the professors in the department went to his apartment, and there was a note on the door from, I think, a neighbor, and everything was closed up, and they could tell he wasn't there. So then they called his family in California, and they immediately felt, they later said, they immediately knew something was wrong, because Pat would not have just walked away.
Well, let me ask you, why are you interested in this story? I mean, what, there's a guy who lives in Charlottesville area for 3 months, a little more than 3 months. He's, what's the polite way to put this? Not of your peers,
right.
Not of your generation.
Though actually 20 years ago, he was
a little closer.
Yeah, he'd be 47 now and I'm 54.
All right. I'm just curious as to what prompted you to go, mm-hmm. Wow, you know, let me start digging through the details here and figuring out what, you know, where this young man might have gone and why these things are being focused on and these things aren't and that whole sort of thing.
It's a big part of the story for me. The year after Pat disappeared, I took a job on the second floor of Jordan Hall. I was a secretary in microbiology, and one of the grad students down the hall had also had a desk in 486. And, of course, this had been a huge, compelling local unsolved mystery for over a year at that point. His parents, Barbara and Clarence, Clarence is actually his stepfather, had come from California, had gotten a lot of media coverage for this frantic search for Barbara's son, and they had left terribly angry at the university for suggesting that Pat had walked away and accusing them of bitterly, bitterly angry, accusing them of negligence. So it was a big mystery, and here I was suddenly working in Jordan Hall. And so I talked to Brad Cobb, the grad student, and he told me about how he had had some checks stolen, and he's certain that it was they were stolen from his backpack in 486 when he had left it unattended, and that they had been cashed within a couple of days of Pat's last being seen. So the police had quickly figured out who had done it. It was a guy who was basically raiding Jordan Hall every time he had a doctor appointment here. He'd worked as an asbestos removal worker and had been hurt on the job. And every time he came back to Charlottesville, he'd moved out of town for an orthopedic appointment, he would go through the hospital and steal. And I remember that time. You couldn't leave your office without coming back and finding out you'd been burgled. Well, this guy ran with three pals, and they were well known to wipe places out. So they figured out pretty fast who it was. And Pat's parents became convinced then, and still believe, that what happened was that Pat had come in that Saturday night, interrupted this burglary, and that they had killed him. And then because the new hospital was being built next to Jordan Hall back then, with all these deep excavation pits, that they tossed him in a hole and it had been covered by concrete. So there's a popular legend around town that Pat's buried under the new hospital. Well, I don't believe that.
Well, let me ask you, before we get too far away from this, did I hear you say that you met a man who shared the room, the study room, with Pat?
Yeah.
How does he not notice that the bag and the keys and the ID that you mentioned earlier are sitting on the desk for 2 weeks, not being moved? I mean, does he think that he walks in every day and Pat's tossing his stuff in the exact same position in the exact same spot? That seems kind of weird to me.
That's a real good question. Actually, I know this room well. Let me get to that in just a second. Years later, then, after being fascinated by this case, I mean, just riveted by it, in 1996, I became the fearless consumer for The Hook. And suddenly, you know, had a forum for my writing. And Hawes Spencer, then editor of Seville, now editor of Hook, where I write, was also fascinated by it. So he had, in fact, almost written about it some time before that. So he said, yeah, you take the story, because by then I had been for several years working in physiology in Pat's whole department, and I was right around the corner from room 486 and fascinated by it. So that's when it became my consuming passion, in fact, telling Pat's story. Well, in this room, don't picture it as a typical office. It was a room, and still is, where graduate students in physiology were given desk space. They might be there once every few days between a lab and a class, just to pick something up. No one then or now sits there hour after hour and really notices. So it would have taken someone who really was spending a lot of time in there watching who came and went to even notice this. And Brad may have only been there. He was apparently there basically long enough to drop his backpack off and then head off somewhere else. So everyone claims that they were completely oblivious to this.
All right, 11:15 here in the wake-up call with Barbara Norden as we talk about the 20-year anniversary of the disappearance of Pat Collins. We'll have the weather coming up in a few moments, and after that we'll start taking phone calls. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Jeff and Michael are here today. They'll be taking phone calls in just a minute or two. Now back to Barbara. Alright, so we've sort of laid out the basics of the case. He disappears. What happens then? The police come in, right?
Oh, in a manner of speaking, the police came in. They seemed determined, oddly fixed on the idea from the beginning that he had walked away. The police officer, Tracy Craner, who was called by Pat's advisor to come check out, start looking for him, went into room 486 and actually handled everything in his backpack.
What do you mean handled it?
Like reached in and, it touched everything. So, fingerprint evidence would be compromised. Of course, no one would have thought of those in those terms. They get a lot of missing student reports, and 99.9% show back up. She tossed away some rotting fruit his landlady had given him right before he disappeared, and just was determined, said, oh, he probably got a bad grade on an exam. He'll be back. Well, the student who had noticed his absence and his advisor, Gary Owens, were standing there saying that, something really doesn't feel right. Gary says, he said, shouldn't you be wearing gloves or something? No, he'll come back. Well, as they realized, they were getting a little bit of heat from the family quickly and from people in physiology, we really do think you should be looking into this. They sent an officer over to look at his apartment to make sure he hadn't committed suicide. But even though there were signs in the apartment that something wasn't right, like, for instance, it was the end of March. Well, by then it was April. But the calendar sheet for March had been torn off, even though we know that he had not been seen and apparently had not been present after March 21st, which suggests that he might have left a note or a date or, a phone number that someone didn't want the police to see.
Isn't it taking the negative attitude?
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know that there's a positive attitude to take. and I suppose that's the police theory, is how they're supposed to come in and view things. And I can see where it would be incorrect for the officer to come in and start compromising a potential crime scene. But is your approach to the topic one of, did you start thinking that he was murdered and then try and fill in the pieces? Or did you try and fill in the pieces and then say, oh, well, they tell me that he was murdered. Those clues tell me that he was murdered.
That's a real good question. I think there are certainly cases where
I watch a lot of Law and Order.
Yeah, it's very hard to go into the Pat Collins case, especially as I did 10 years after it happened, and knowing as much as I knew in the meantime. 10 years later, when this guy whose whole dream had been to come to graduate school, who showed no signs whatsoever of having, you know, mental problems or financial or legal problems, his social security number in all those years has never been used. He has never, ever been seen again. He was very close to his family. It just really boggles the mind to think that, in fact, he had walked away. And then on the other side of the ledger, you see a security force, basically, which is what UVA police were back then, bound and determined to assume that this guy had walked away, and also very unwilling to be open about what they did or didn't do during their investigation. I also turned up very clear evidence that he apparently had been being stalked by another man who was coming around at night and early evening, he was observed. This man was observed by a neighbor who unfortunately is now dead, along with just about everybody else. She said he came on probably about half a dozen occasions and would stand on their side of the fence looking across at Pat's basement apartment, waiting apparently until he came out. Sometimes she would see them leaving together and other times not. Pat worked out a lot he was in the gymnastics club anyway, at Mem Gym. So we know he was there at least once a week. And given how very athletic he could walk 100 steps on his feet, you know, that kind of thing.
100 steps on his feet?
Yeah.
Or I can do that.
I mean, I'm sorry. On his hands. Oh, God. I'm so glad you got that. He could walk 100 steps on his hands. He was just amazing. And Mem Gym in the mid-80s was an aggressive, no-holds-barred cruising ground for anonymous gay sex, which I won't go into all the details, but later got toned down a bit. But back then, it was pretty much anything goes. Pat, I suspect, from sort of what I can put together about psychological signs about his past with women and his family history, I suspect strongly, and there's some evidence for this, that he was probably edging out of the closet here. And what I'm wondering about is if maybe someone at Mem Gym that he had met, who initially was probably very appealing to him, then couldn't get rid of. And I can just picture him coming out of his apartment and saying, "Oh, you're here again. You know, what are you doing here? I told you not to come here. Let's just, you know, get out of here. I'll leave with you if you'll just leave. I don't want people to see you." And I suspect that this is someone who probably got very jealous. I've talked to an FBI profiler who was called in on the case. Now, interestingly enough, he was not called in to look at a potential murderer, though he says that he assumed from the beginning that Pat was dead. This is all so bizarre. He says he also didn't know that the UVA police hadn't really interviewed much of anybody. He talked to just a few people around the department. I mean, the UVA police did. They didn't interview any neighbors except the landlady in the hospital. They didn't do any forensic work in his apartment or his car. They didn't do anything that the FBI would have done.
All right, well, let's take a quick break. You're welcome to dial up and ask Barbara some questions or get some comments. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. I realize it's Easter Sunday, but I also know that not everybody out there is at church. Markets have talked a few forecasts for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Partly cloudy with afternoon thunderstorms today. Highs 70 to 75. Storms possibly severe tonight. Lows 45 to 50. Showers with possibly severe thunderstorms tomorrow. Highs 55 to 60. Right now in the valley, there's some light rain, 60 degrees. Partly cloudy in Lynchburg and 62. Cloudy in Richmond and Charlottesville. Warm down in the Richmond area in 66. Just 61 here in town.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And we always want to thank our folks at Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, where April is Footwear Month. New spring styles are in with sandals. Plus hikers and trail runners from the North Face, Merrill, Montrail, and Vasque. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barrack Road Shopping Center, Charlottesville. Charlottesville, now the king of the universe. As you didn't know, and WNRN slowly overtaking the rest of the universe. You could be listening on the new 95.9 down in Lexington. Also WNRN. Lexington, Richmond, Lynchburg, Stanton, Waynesboro. Shortly moving into, where are we going next, Jeff? Farmville, Harrisonburg. Yeah. Lovingston. Yeah, we'll be overtaking everyone soon, so damn well better like what we're doing. All right, Barbara, we're back. 11:25 on the wake-up call as we talk about the disappearance of Patrick Collins with local investigative reporter and journalist Barbara Norden. Barbara, I'm curious. You keep talking about the UVA police doing this and not doing that. Why are they in charge of this? Aren't they, and I'm not trying to demean anybody, but aren't they school security? Why are they investigating a whether they treated it as such or not, why are they investigating a potential murder case? Where's Albemarle County? Because isn't the school technically an Albemarle County location? Or where are the Charlottesville police? Why is school security investigating this?
An excellent question. One of the tragedies is that if Pat had disappeared a few years later, Charlottesville police would have taken the case because by then state law had changed and that when a person disappears, he or she is considered to have disappeared from their residence. I mean, even if they know that you didn't. If you're a resident of, say, Nelson County, then I guess Nelson County police has dibs on getting involved in your disappearance no matter where you were last seen. So, no, UVA police had jurisdiction, and believe it or not, and I followed this up, they could not have been forced to relinquish that, and they were not going to. Charlottesville police and Albemarle County police were sort of on the sidelines. I think that for Charlottesville police it was especially agonizing. They could only stand by while UVA police would come onto city turf, like at his apartment. They would send a city police person to officially be present when they went in and looked at the apartment, that kind of thing. But no one could compel UVA to ask any other agency to assist them, even though they had never investigated a possible homicide. One of the real complex elements in this case is that Clarence Shannon, Pat's stepfather, who is, I think, just a very fine person, It was a retired big city cop. And the ego clash between the UVA police and Clarence Shannon was absolutely colossal. Here was someone who had really lived police work and done, you know, all homicides, kidnappings, missing persons, just the whole in San Jose, in California. He'd had a whole career with it. So he knew that, he kept saying, you know, shouldn't you be doing some fingerprinting? Shouldn't you be doing... And they'd say, Mr. Shannon, we've got everything under control. Thanks for your help, but we don't need it. So if Clarence Shannon suggested something, no matter how obvious, they were damned if they were going to do it. So there was a lot of antagonism, very sadly, between the family and the university. It was terrible. And then if people have read the coverage of the alleged rape in the fraternity from that same era that's being played out now, where the man fascinatingly wrote the woman to apologize and is now here in the region being tried for the crime, you will know that both the victim, the alleged victim, Liz Sicuro, and her father say that at the time they were really discouraged by the UVA police from going forward with this. This was all right before the Clery Act passed, which began when the Clary's daughter, Jean, was murdered the morning after Pat's disappearance was discovered. Ironically, April 5th, 1986, their daughter was horribly murdered in her dorm room at Lehigh University. And they, between the settlement they got from Lehigh for negligent security in the dorms and their own, they were already very, very wealthy people, they set up a foundation called Security on Campus, which shortly got national legislation passed that universities and colleges have to publicize their crime statistics. This made it hard for universities and colleges to cover up such things as rapes and missing students that never showed up. So UVA, like every other college and university probably in the country at the time, really wasn't eager to have students or their families take cases up to a higher level.
Why did the university believe that Patrick had just walked away? And they still believe that, correct? I mean, you mentioned earlier.
No. They know. They know in their hearts. Mike Sheffield, the chief of police at the time, who's now retired, I have the feeling he probably has nightmares about Pat Collins. That's an interesting thing. I don't know why they were so determined. Now, one thing that's very suggestive to me, I was told by someone who is long since retired from the police department at UVA, but who was called into the case, you worked there then, obviously, about a week into it. His memory, and he cannot be sure, he told me that his memory was that when he was being briefed on the details after he joined the group that was supposedly investigating it a week into it, was that a group had gone over to Mem Gym, talked to members of the gymnastics club, which he belonged to, and was told by them that their impression was that Pat had been gay. I suspect that they were so homophobic that at that time, and a friend who also was a UVA police officer for many years, and or not many years, in fact, she got out of police work entirely and now is a teacher, she told me that the word on the police grapevine, and when she left UVA, she went to another regional police force, she said that the word on the police grapevine back then was that Pat couldn't handle coming out to his, quote-unquote, militaristic stepfather, which is not Clarence Shannon at all. He's not at all militaristic. And that he walked away from his life. That this was just something they swallowed hook, line, and sinker. Oh, well, he was probably gay and he couldn't handle it. And he walked away from his life. And they probably really believed for that first, even maybe the first few months, when the family first tried a couple years later under Freedom of Information Act to get the police file open to them. And they had been assured at the time, and I have this in writing, I have six big documents, binders full of documents, saying, oh, we're going to let you see, we're going to sit down and show you the file we've got. Well, suddenly, when they tried under Freedom of Information to get it, all of a sudden, Mike Sheffield had classified it as a criminal investigation. Up till then, of course, they just said, oh, no, he walked away from his life. We don't see any reason to take this any further. Well, and 20 years later, they're still telling me that. I got a letter just a few weeks ago. Every time, I get ready to talk about it or write about it, I write the current chief of police and under Freedom of Information Act, and I got the same letter I always get saying that it was under active investigation. I've tried to get Rick Cass, the general counsel at the university, and Dave Chapman, the Commonwealth's attorney for the city of Charlottesville, to sit down with me and to tell me, give me some details. What does this active investigation consist of? What was so shocking to me is that if at the time UVA thought he had walked away, why wouldn't they want to show the family everything they had done? Any possible clues that could lead the parents to say, well, you know what? That makes us think that maybe he did walk away. Right. So the reason they don't want me or the family to see the file isn't because there's damning evidence in there that, you know, they know who killed him or they know that he walked away. It's damning evidence that they didn't do anything.
11:34 here on the Wake Up Call with Barbara Norton as we talk about the 20-year investigation or not of the disappearance of Patrick Collins. Five Guys Burgers and Fries needs to be thanked for allowing us to put the show on the air today. They are the reader's choice for burgers. Rated by Zagat Restaurant Survey for 4 years running, Five Guys serves America standard, fresh and handmade from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. And they're open until 10 Fridays and Saturdays. Five Guys Burgers and Fries is behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center and now open at the Hollymead Town Center. Coming soon to the downtown mall in Charlottesville. 975 Guys. Call us up if you have questions for Barbara or want to make a comment on the topic at hand. 979-0919 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Maybe from our new 95.9 in Lexington or some of the other folks, Lynchburg, Benton, Waynesboro, Richmond, etc. Barbara, you mentioned earlier that I guess you, someone, believes that Patrick might have or was likely killed by walking in on a crime, a burglary in the in his room 46. So what does it matter that he might have been coming out as a gay, hanging out at the Mem Gym and the gymnastics club, etc.? Why is that worth mentioning?
Because it's far more likely, in terms of just criminal statistics, that he would have been murdered under those circumstances than that this group, who had a long history of petty theft, but who had never been violent. This group, known to have, you know, taken Brad Cobb's checks, were milquetoast. In fact, I've talked to the guy, and he will not talk about what happened in that room if he saw anything or didn't see something like his backpack or whatever. He just won't talk about it. Anyway, the thought that he would have, that they would have murdered him, and remember, he was a black belt. He was a very strong man. This would have been, the room would have been ripped apart. He would have made all kinds of noise. There would have been some kind of evidence of, you know, someone killed in that room. And also, it's just a myth that it's easy to lose a body at a construction site. It's not. They don't just go around saying, oh, let's, you know, pour a million tons of concrete in this hole. They go down and they put rebar in, and they have to have, you know, all kinds of documentation of what they did when, and it just doesn't hold water. But the FBI profiler, when he found out about the guy at the fence, he's actually been very helpful to me now. Immediately, that rang a big bell for him, and he could imagine easily a scenario where, yes, indeed, Pat couldn't get rid of him, and perhaps had become friendly with someone else. Guy was just driven to jealousy or was just furious that Pat was trying to get rid of him. Now, there's some psychological history in Pat's family that sadly buttresses the view that Pat might have been drawn to that kind of charismatic, lethal, Mr. Goodbar kind of guy. His father was terribly violent. He was a violent alcoholic who would
not the guy you've been talking about. Not the guy who was
officer. Yeah, sorry.
That guy was his stepfather.
Yeah, no. Clarence was their father, Billy Collins' police partner. And so they grew up with Sergeant Shannon being this kind, nice guy, and then Dad being this horrible, violent alcoholic who would beat him up and would just awful. As evidence of his Pat's father's mental stability, when Barbara, their mother, was working nights at one point, she had a daughter from her first marriage. Now, this gets a little bit complex. She had murdered her first husband. So that's an interesting part of the family scrapbook.
I'm
know.
Because it's weird.
Mom murdering Fawn's father. She had murdered her first husband when Fawn, the half-sister, was a baby. Apparently he was an alcoholic, violent guy too, according to her. Her defense was self-defense. I'm sure that was, you know, legitimate. She shot him. She dragged his body into a closet, left it there for a couple days, and called her father and said, "Ooh, I think I have a problem."
Wonder what the defense was for that.
Yeah, I'd love to see the trial transcript. So she quickly married Billy Collins, who was apparently a very charismatic, appealing guy who was on the police force. He was also, according to Clarence, a dirty cop who was eventually fired by the San Jose police. The marriage, they immediately had Michael and then Pat, and they had, of course, Fawn from Barbara's first marriage. Well, so life goes on for a while, and then one night when Barbara was working nights, she gets a call from the police. Billy Collins has raped Fawn, his stepdaughter, Pat and Michael's sister. So she came home, and, you know, Pat and Michael had to, I assume, go through the ordeal of seeing their father being hauled away in the middle of the night by the police. Not only did she agree to drop the charges, but she actually continued letting him live with them. So Fawn, who was 13 at the time, had to go through until she could graduate from high school and get out of there, which she did. She had to live with her rapist. And the second she could get away, she was gone and was basically largely estranged from the rest of the family the rest of her life. It was terribly sad. She and Barbara apparently did reach, and certainly she had no problem with her brothers, but...
So because Billy was such a
Billy was
violent,
a
charismatic man, that you think that Pat grew up with some sort of inner attraction to similar men?
I suspect strongly that Billy, if he sexually, you know, he was obviously a predator. He raped Fawn. I think there's a very good chance that he molested one or both of the boys. We have no evidence except for a relationship he had right before he moved from San Jose to come to UVA, a short relationship with a woman he cared for a great deal. In fact, really that was his first relationship with a woman, and that's also of a piece with someone who may have been sexually abused as a child and may also have a lot of doubts about his sexual orientation. He was 26 when he had that probably first relationship. It's pretty rare. So, yeah, I think there's a psychological evidence that someone with that kind of background, sort of slowly edging his way out of the closet and being in a place like the Mem Gym locker room every week, could well have been drawn to someone like Billy, you know, charismatic and then really lethal, really violent, very possessive, who he just could not get to leave him alone, especially if the guy observed him getting close to someone else. Now, one bit of evidence that was never, ever resolved was there was a cool cigarette butt, a water-stained cool cigarette butt in Pat's trash in his apartment, and Pat was very, you know, athletic and very anti-smoking. Cool cigarettes statistically are more likely to be smoked by black men. That's pretty much their constituency as black males. I have wondered, a lot of people have wondered over the years, whether that cigarette butt might have been left there by someone Pat actually was close enough to, that he, you know, would let him get rid of it in his trash.
And like the guy who's been watching outside his window.
No, unlike that guy. Like the guy outside the window could have been observing Pat getting close to this other guy.
Oh, I see.
And that could have been the thing that touched him off. He could have realized that Pat was establishing a relationship with another person. There were no black graduate students during that era in Pat's class. Could easily have been someone, and this may be apocryphal. Apparently, someone later said that they had seen a black man running through the backyard and jumping over the fence. I don't know about that. I can't help but wonder whether perhaps Pat, it could have been the stalker, but it could have just been someone Pat was getting to know and the stalker didn't like that.
All right, 11:43 here on the Wake Up Call as we talk with Barbara Norton about the 20-year mystery, the disappearance of Patrick Collins.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, did the Daily Progress do anything wrong by printing the names and photos of local teens who plan to blow up two local high schools? The Hook gets some opinions. A local journalism professor tells us to turn off our TV this week, as it's the plug-in drug that's slowly killing us. And visit with Robert Randolph, the man reviving the pedal steel guitar, The Hook. Call today for your free estimate. Deb NRN wants to congratulate some really big grand prize winners from the Spring Fund Drive. Monday afternoon's drawing, Bill and Janet Smith of Stanton won the second of two weekend stays at the Hampton Inn and Suites University. Mike Henrietta of Charlottesville won the summer 2006 membership at Fry Springs Club. And Patrick Henberry, also of Charlottesville, picked up the complete computer system from PC Pro in the Woodbrook Shopping Center. Pay your pledge to the NRN Spring 06 Fund Drive as soon as possible, while we still have the best selection of fashion and other premium items, and to make yourself eligible for contest add-ons for NRN members. Thanks again to everyone who helped us to our best fund drive ever from all of us at WNRN. And it's not just the people who pledge, but it's also the underwriters like Blue Ridge Graphics. Meade Avenue at East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom t-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. All right, 11:45 here on the wake-up call. 15 minutes left with Barbara Norton.
Put in a sort of personal note here.
That's really what the program's all about.
Okay. Well, to show you how excited I am by this case, I just think that the psychological complexity here and the drama of watching this blue-collar couple in California confronting this sort of blue-blood institution is so compelling. I've applied for and been accepted to the Master of Fine Arts program in creative nonfiction at Goucher College in Baltimore. I won't be leaving here. It's largely distance learning. But my ultimate goal with that degree is mainly to finally get enough mentorship and enough connections during those 2 years to bring to fruition a book I have tried and tried to make people understand is compelling, even though I don't have a dead body. And I've figured out that the way I'll need to structure this is that Pat's story will run through the center of the narrative, but I will weave around the narrative about Pat other unsolved or strange stories about Charlottesville, one that's unfolding right now that I think is absolutely bizarre to the extreme, is that my former neighbor, Kurt Krobaugh, is coming up at long last for sentencing May 9th in his completely wacko attempt to kill his then estranged wife, Jane, over on Terrell Road. He's the one who put on the werewolf mask and apparently hoofed it across town in the middle of the night from St. Clair Avenue to Terrell Road, which is off Georgetown Road, so someone in the middle of the night going basically from Martha Jefferson Hospital over to Charlottesville High, or Albemarle High.
And didn't attract any attention?
This just blows my mind. And in case you're picturing some guy with a beer belly cleaning his gun collection, no, that's the guy down St. Clair who sells the AK-47s I wrote about in The Fearless Consumer. Kurt is a highly educated. He was he worked for a high-flying financial firm in New York as a mergers and acquisitions specialist, and he had a degree from Iowa in film studies. He'd studied philosophy in Paris, and, you know, we thought he was a pretty nice guy. And next thing we know, sitting in my desk a couple days after the election in November of last year, thinking, oh, I'm so depressed I can barely move. Well, I never got around to reading Tuesday's paper. Oh, my God, Kurt has been arrested. And from then on, I have been absolutely gripped by the drama. Courtney Stewart did a fabulous cover story a couple of months ago for The Hook on the case, and Kurt has run out of options now to drag it out any longer. He will be sentenced. There are no more continuations for him. He will be sentenced May 9th in Charlottesville Circuit Court. And I am counting the days. I cannot wait to see what he gets, how many years, how long he'll be sent down the river or up the river. And it's a fascinating story.
Well, good luck on the book.
Thank you.
I'm sure that a lot of folks who followed the Pat Collins case, as well as the others through the years, both your articles that you've written, the shows you've been on, et cetera, will be interested in picking that up. Back to the last few minutes here on the disappearance of Pat Collins. I'm curious about suspects that have been weeded out or still there. I mean, there's, I guess initially on almost every murder, there's the family, friends, and lovers aspect. You mentioned potential lover.
Mm-hmm.
But not much about friends or family as possible aspects. You said that he was close to his family members, at least to his parents, but he has also had a lot of, seems like he had at least a couple siblings who might have also been mentally distraught or disturbed based on some of their the methods in which they grew up. You know, was there any insurance or anything like that that needed to be worried about?
No, he was a penniless graduate student.
Other siblings, not other siblings, other peers in the program that he needed to worry about? At some point, whether I read it or whether we talked about it on another show, an episode here on the Wake Up Call, he went on some weekend trip with people and et cetera. You know, so I'm just curious about how either you or the university police, if they discovered anything, said, all right, these people, we don't have to worry about anymore.
The Valentine's Day weekend trip to the Poconos is one of the most fascinating aspects of this case for me. He went to the Poconos with two fellow graduate students and a postdoctoral fellow, John Sisk. John was a postdoc. The two fellow students were Doug and Jeff. And we will never know, I guess, for sure, but I strongly suspect that something happened during that weekend that Jeff and Doug later were uncomfortable with. Barbara told me that during their time in Charlottesville...
Barbara, his mother.
His mother, yeah. During their month in Charlottesville, where they were widely covered on radio, TV, and in the progress of all the dozens and dozens of people they met, people offered them money, places to stay, said, what can we do to help? Doug and Jeff were the only people they met who were uncomfortable. And she said that they were nervous and shifty-eyed when they talked to him and clearly did not want to talk to him. When I first started investigating the case, I was a secretary still in physiology, and one of the professors who had known Pat said, you know, Doug is now, he graduated, he'd done a postdoc, and he says he's thinking about going to medical school, and he's applying to UVA, so he's here for an interview. And I told him that you're looking into Pat's case, and he said he'd be willing to talk to you. So he brought Doug to my office a few days later, and I looked at him and said, Doug, you were one of the guys who went on the Poconos trip. And he looked at me, and I'll never forget his eyes. He just looked sort of dead, and he said, no, I wasn't, Barbara. This sort of robotic witness. I thought, well, geez, I guess the Daily Progress got it wrong, because at the time, the Progress had done extensive coverage, and they'd listed all three guys who'd gone with him. I didn't think much of it. But then a year or so later, I tracked down John Sisk, the postdoc, and the only one of the four men who was married, though the other two are married now and have kids. And we were talking about the weekend, and he said, and I remember, you know, Doug, and I said, wait, Doug wasn't there. And he said, oh, yes, he was. He's like, I remember, and he was cross-country skiing in the moonlight in a cornfield. And I said, oh, ho, how interesting. It took me another couple of years. I felt so awkward about this. I finally emailed Doug, who by then was in med school at the Mayo Clinic. Said, Doug, look, were you on this trip or not? And he said, I was, but I don't remember it. Jeff also had said that he couldn't remember anything about the weekend. He had to admit he was there because his parents owned the cabin. But But here you are, one of three people, the only people on Earth that could ever be found afterwards who had ever socialized, you know, enough to actually go out of town with this guy who 6 weeks later had disappeared off the face of the Earth and is the subject of intense, intense media scrutiny in this small town you live in. And you can't remember anything about the weekend. That's the kind of thing that people dine out on for the rest of their lives. I remember him. He brought his telescope, which he did. He sat up late, and, you know, I don't buy it. I think that either something happened that they were uncomfortable with.
Maybe they just all got drunk and forgot about it.
Well, or maybe they got drunk and someone made moves on someone. Or, alternatively, that they realized later that they had seen something during those 2 weeks that would have been helpful to the police if they had told about it. I don't think that holds much water, because I think they would have said it. I mean, Doug was the one who actually went to the advisor and said, we think something's, you know, Pat's disappeared. He would have said right then, you know what, now that I think about it, I noticed that his pack has been there for 2 weeks. He didn't say anything. So I think it's something that happened on that weekend that they didn't really want to deal with.
All right, you are listening to the Wake Up Call here on Easter Sunday. Barbara Nordend, journalist and investigative reporter here in town, discussing the disappearance of Patrick Collins from 20 years ago. I do want to thank 45Fix for their support today. 45Fix.com. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45Fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45Fix.com. The number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And as we finish up our program, don't go anywhere, because at noon, George Bell is here for Les Temps Purdue. Everybody cheer. It's the best of 80s and 90s alternative. He refuses, out of spite, to play Boston, Tiffany, or Whitesnake. They got nice hair. But you will hear Smashing Pumpkins, Sonic Youth, and New Order, and requests are always welcome. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. And in case you weren't sure where you were, this is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar, Amherst, Lynchburg, 1156. All right, Barbara, we've got just a few minutes left. I want to know the story about the package that was mailed to Patrick's house years after he disappeared.
Well, I only heard that because a caller, when I was on several years ago, called in. And
I thought you told me the story, and then the caller called. You told me the story about the package.
Thank you, Rick.
And then there was a caller who
thank you. No, that's absolutely true.
Wanted to make sure it was cleared up.
A coworker at my day job is related to Pat's landlady, who's, of course, along with everyone else, is dead. She died very soon after this whole thing happened. And they had inherited the house from her, and a package was delivered to their house. I can't remember if it was FedEx or UPS, addressed to Pat. And they say they called the UVA police, even though this was, you know, 2-3 years after he disappeared, and they were, like, achingly aware that they'd been accused of really screwing this up. And they say they were told to just, you know, call UPS or whatever up and send it back, you know, just refuse it. And they don't remember anything about the package. That's right. Their daughter, I think, then called and clarified something. I'm not sure what. But
well, my memory is that your claim, or your co-worker's claim, was that the package had been delivered, and which we thought was kind of creepy. But then this woman, who I guess lives in the house now,
to
the landlady
from like 20 years ago,
called
right.
And said, we never accepted it. We immediately denied it. We immediately sent it back. So nobody ever opened this package. Nobody knew where it came from. Nobody knew anything else. Although it was years after Patrick had been lost.
I can't remember the details. I think that I later learned from family members that the caller is someone who tends to get a little bit paranoid about
Let me toss this other thing out, because we just got a minute left. One thing that we did last time that you were here, which I think was about 5 years ago, was we played a phone message tape, because there was something you thought was important about the number of, like, hang-up phone calls that he received after he had been missing.
Yeah, he got an incredible number of hang-ups on his answering machine tape, which, of course, if UVA had done any forensic work, they could have sent to Quantico, and they could have amplified the one message that could have been important. I tried to get Virginia Arts Studio to do something with it, and they tried, and it's really ancient. But anyway, someone seemed to be leaving a message with a phone number. Now, no one, and it said something about call me with your specifications. But they weren't aware of Pat building any shelves or anything. It was very strange. And that's the kind of thing that if it had been handled properly at the time, UVA police could have probably gotten a lead from. They could have gone to Mem Jim and asked people to describe who they'd ever seen Pat with. They could have done fingerprint stuff. They could have analyzed the calendar sheet. You know, they could have just done so many things that they declined to do. There's controversy over the calendar sheet, whether they did anything or not, but apparently it was ultimately lost. So I just want to honor Pat's memory. He was, for everything I know about him, he was a fine person. And
well, obviously, we can fill the hour pretty easily talking about it, and there's still more to discuss. But George needs to take over and get his time here on the live mic.
Well, thanks,
Barbara,
for having
I want to
me
thank
back.
You for coming on. I find it to be a fascinating topic. I hope you do get your book out sometime soon. And if not, look for us in, 2011 when we do the 25-year anniversary.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be out by then, I swear to God.
Adios, amigos.
Bye-bye.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstand Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.rlc.net. The wake-up call is produced by Catherine Greiner. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.